story of Thoreau is one of the most interesting, probably, in English literature. And the peculiar survival of his book, Walden, points to the basic instincts of millions of persons. Although all this grand experiment which he made occurred more than 100 years ago, in times quite different from our own, the book has never lost its basic vitality for gentle and thoughtful readers. The influence of this book has reached out into many countries and has affected the social and political development of nations far from the consciousness of the original author. Mohandas Gandhi paid a wonderful tribute to Thoreau, declaring that Walden had exercised a powerful influence on his moral character and the development of his concepts of a simple way of life for the people of India. That such should have been the case is rather evident, for Thoreau had some understanding of Asia. And in his book, he quotes many of the literary sources of Hindu scriptural writings, which were favored by the Emersonian group in Concord during his time. Indian philosophy reached New England through the Transcendentalist group, which included Emerson and Thoreau. Emerson was a personal friend of the young man and assisted in the financing of his education. At least he interceded for Thoreau at Harvard, and the young man therefore received an excellent education. His indifference, however, to academic procedure is clearly indicated in his book, and when the time came for his graduation, he did not feel that it was worth the $5 expenses involved, so he never officially graduated. The study of Walden depends upon some type of knowledge of the author. We cannot divide a man from his work, and most books that have impressed history have been to a measure autobiographical. In order to understand the attitude of Thoreau, we must come back to perhaps the most famous story associated with him, and that's the story of the Thoreau lead pencil. His father had been considerably concerned with experimenting in the manufacturing of an efficient lead pencil. This fundamental article, that was later to become of the most commonplace of our utilities, intrigued the young man, who improved the design, made it more and more efficient, and produced in the end a completely satisfactory lead pencil. According to his contemporaries, who congratulated him mightily on his achievement, his fame and fortune were assured. The man who could build the best lead pencil would be an immortal. However, Thoreau declined to receive the approbation and announced firmly that he never intended to make another lead pencil. To the astonishment of his friends, he replied simply, "Why should I continue to make lead pencils? I have made lead pencils." And that settles it. This was the picture of the man. He did not believe in the kind of life which lies in bondage to anything. He did not believe that the human being was in this world to become a slave of policies or possessions. Rather, the search was for a free way of life, a life in which man becomes wealthy by needing less rather than by possessing more. Thoreau was convinced that somewhere in the mystery of our existence, we have lost the direct and reasonable purpose for which we were created. By degrees, we have developed one attitude or policy after another. These have become traditional, until today, we are slaves of ways of doing things. And our energy and our lives, which should be devoted to the unfoldment of our own resources, are now in slavery to the gratifications of our desires for comforts, conveniences, and commodities. Now, it would not seem so likely that in 1847, this problem should have burdened a New England intellectual. At that time, Concord had a population of 2,000 souls. And this little community, hidden away in the beauties of nature, would appear to us to be an almost complete hermitage. In those days also, as we gain from interesting study of the methodical mind of this poet naturalist, expenses must have been not too prohibitive. He speaks definitely of the possibility of building a good house for a few hundred dollars. He carried on his great back-to-nature experiment, extending over 2 years and 2 months, with a total expenditure, including the building of his cabin and the maintenance of himself throughout that period, for less than $100. It would not seem under those conditions that the economic burden was weighing heavily upon him. But apparently to his mind, $100 was a symbol. A symbol of the tyranny of economic responsibility. It was not the amount, as we so often say, it was the principle. And Thoreau was fighting against what he regarded as a wrong principle. This principle of the individual dedicating his resources continuously to the perpetuation of a static self within him, a self which was enslaved by needs. And because of this vicious cycle of survival, as man understands it, the human being has little, if any, opportunity to unfold the resources which are naturally his. Undoubtedly, Thoreau would have been very unhappy had he lived in more recent days. Watching the tremendous pressure developing in our modern way of life, he would have realized that his every fear had come to pass, and that a world was gradually losing sight of the dignity of the individual, the purpose of the individual. Losing sight of the essential needs of the individual. And this complete ignoring of essential value may well be responsible for the general increase in psychic tension, which we are now enduring as best we can. Reading the story of Walden, we have to acknowledge that we are in the presence of a work which to us, after the lapse of years, is largely symbolical. Read for the first time, it is interesting, intriguing, perhaps almost a little verbose. The more we consider it, however, the more we realize that Thoreau is telling us in his personal adventure of a larger and far deeper and more valuable experiment. He has been subjected to ridicule. He has been regarded as everything from a madman to a genius. Yet in his own simple way, the entire notoriety which descended upon his experiment was due to his emphasis upon basic principles which men had forgotten or had ignored in their endless struggle for personal advancement. Each of us, therefore, in taking the story of Thoreau, must apply it according to the kind of world in which we live. It is quite obvious that we cannot retire a mile from the center of town, find a pleasant mill pond isolated in the forest, and build there a cabin in which we can create a hermitage, and do all this for a negligible expenditure, and here sun ourselves around the calendar. Such a way of life would probably not only be impossible to us, but contrary to our basic instincts and inclinations. If we were so fortunate, according to perhaps our own desire, to be able to attain such solitude and isolation, we would shortly fall into madness. For instead of finding quietude in aloneness, we would find a wretched isolation, so different from our present way that in a few months we would hurry back to the shelter of our conventional way of living and thinking. Also today, the responsibilities of life are rather different from what they were in the days of Thoreau. The average person cannot break away from the pattern of responsibilities which burden him. Yet in some way, the instinct of escapism, a return to nature, is strong in many, and perhaps in a healthy way is present to a degree in most. Therefore, the story continues to intrigue us, although it becomes more and more a utopian vision or spectacle, peculiarly keyed to a time far different from our own. It is therefore in the light of this that we must understand how a man like Gandhi was affected by this story. Certainly India was nearer to the Pool of Walden than our way of life. But we find in this Indian leader the rise of a strong and powerful modern purpose, in which the works of Thoreau became a source of subtle inspiration and indirect support. Therefore, there is a way in which a work of this kind, though so strange and distant to us, may yet have meaning. To Thoreau, the story of Back to Nature is identical with the concept of back to self. That somewhere, some way, each individual must experience his existence in a true world, a world not fashioned by his own imagery, a world that is not the result of the interlocking of concepts, but a world which has a closeness to the earth, a world of values that are direct, natural, simple, and inevitable. If we cannot, therefore, go to this world from our own abodes, then we must bring this world to ourselves. We must discover it by a code of conduct or a series of internal revelations, so that if nature around us is denied us, nature can still live within us and become the basis of a normalcy and a vitality which can carry us over the doubts and problems of the years. Under various research experiments today, we are making discoveries that are of great interest, philosophically, religiously, psychologically. Among these discoveries is the increasing realization of the potential universality of man's inner life. We used to believe that within man there was a mysterious darkness hiding a spiritual core, and that this constituted largely his interior construction. Today we realize more fully that every power and faculty within man is capable of numerous developments, among others visualization, that all of the sensory perceptions have their own works within man. And under hypnosis, under certain drugs that are being experimented with, it is learned that man can and does become keenly aware of a universal interior existence. That this interior existence, like the Elysian fields of the Egyptians and Greeks, is not merely a remote paradisical state, but that within man is the primordial garden of life. That in his own nature he can restore the Edenic world that he hears of or reads of in ancient sacred writings. In our dreams, we can find ourselves in rich pastures with beautiful flowers. We can escape into mountains and valleys. We can build our hermitage under the walls of a great cliff or hill and watch a stream run by the door of our retreat. We can visualize or relive all of these conditions in ourselves because they are in ourselves. We can restore Walden's pleasant pond and perhaps understand better than Thoreau did why this pond was only a mile from the center of the busy community in which he lived at that time. The quietude of the forest, the gentleness of solitary places, these moods and qualities are within us. And back to nature and back to self become increasingly important as directives and as goals while we observe the results of our artificial ways and our false allegiances. Thoreau, therefore, tells us in the beginning of the importance and dignity of simplicity. And from the standpoint of the modern psychologist, we perhaps can restore something of this in terms of analytical symbolism. The average person under analysis must first unload. He is filled to the brim with psychic acidities. He is loaded with a sour and useless wine that has not been well preserved. He is therefore internally sick. He is sick because when he attempts to find the natural solitudes of his own life, he comes face to face with chaos. Modern analysts are becoming less anxious to unlock the subconscious life of man, because when they do so, from this Pandora's box, there comes forth such a host of pests and pestilences that it seems they cannot be controlled. Thus, what we call civilization is a veneer of restraint. It is of surface frustration, a kind of shell beneath the surface of which, like the thin crust of the earth near Mount Vesuvius, is a seething turmoil of fire and lava. This thin crust, then, of our self-control, this surfacing made respectable by ages of cultivation, covers an area which is dismal and difficult. And we dare not live except upon this surface. For if we arise above it, we move into worlds we know not of. And if we descend below this surface, we enter into a state of internals which we cannot endure. There is something very wrong with a way of life that makes for such pressure within the individual. This pressure forbids nearly every legitimate achievement. It comes through continuously in small releases as tension, stress, pain, fear, doubt, anger. It is always interfering with the simple directness of our conduct. It is making us enemies for no reason. It is causing us to be eternally suspicious of things which are not actually the proper objects for suspicion. It also, most of all, detracts from our right to know ourselves. For when we turn in upon our own natures, what we find is not ourselves. It is the accumulation of other persons in us. It is the accumulation of ages of history. It is the outside pressing in upon us until it has deformed every internal part of our own natures. So man looking in today finds only the world which he has fashioned. And because outwardly he has dedicated everything to the creation of this vast monument, which is a mausoleum to his own defeat, he finds within himself only the same barren, sterile regions as those which he has fashioned with the battlefields of his external existence. Some way, Thoreau sensed this. He realized, even in a far less intense generation, that this was the direction the world was moving. It was moving into an oppressing complexity. It was moving into sickness. It was gradually removing from the individual the vitality to survive, and most of all, the vitality to correct his own faults. The individual became dependent, no longer upon himself, but upon everything else. He was therefore at the mercy of the outside world which he himself had brought into being. Like the characters in Dante's Inferno, he was being punished by his own deeds and by the illusions that followed after them. As he expresses it, this man, this farmer, dragging his house down through the years with him, living for his house, living to clear his land, to take away the rocks, living within a small world in which there was no time for reading, or for thought, or for contemplation, because of the endless cycle of the drudgery of existence. Yet out of this drudgery, what did the man actually achieve? He achieved so little. And of that which he did achieve, most went to the survival of the body upon which he depended for the strength for drudgery. He ate and slept in order that he might work. And he worked in order that he might eat and sleep. And so he went on and on and on. And this noblest of the creatures, this being with imagination, with poetry in his soul, with dreams and hopes and aspirations, as Thoreau says, was plowed under in his own furrows. He followed the plow until he died with the plow. And all that was real and beautiful and wonderful about him was locked in this strange concept of the need for a particular and peculiar kind of survival, a competitive survival, based utterly and completely upon a code which he himself had fashioned.
He had made his own deadline, and he died with it.
Thoreau was not the kind of person, however, who was by nature violent, nor subject to the concept of revolutions. He did not believe that there would be any advantage in trying to force men from their present courses. He realized that some persons would be utterly and totally miserable if they were confronted with the opportunity to be happy. Their entire way of life has been dedicated to a kind of martyrdom, and they feel it righteousness. They feel it their duty, their responsibility, to share in the common miseries of their kind. They have never been stirred by any strong resolution to correct the misery. They have only been impelled to the virtue of patience, which endures error to the end and never mends it. This attitude can only today apply to the individual himself in his adjustments with life around him. It is certain, however, that the habit of immoderation increases with good exercise, and as any part much used becomes stronger, so the part of us that makes mistakes, when given great encouragement, increases and intensifies. By degrees, we lose any close contact with realities, with vitalities, and with the essential values by which our lives might be more correctly and properly directed. For each of us, therefore, the pond of Walden represents a kind of retreat. And for every man, there must be a retreat into himself. And when he retreats into himself, he should find there strength. But medical science today, exploring the subconscious and unconscious of the average person, finds not strength but the root of weakness. Finds that a large part of man's internal life is so disordered that he cannot live well. How then shall we estimate the value of systems? What shall we say of education that permits a man to go through his own life, and most of it, with a total unwellness in himself? What shall we say of progress, of culture, of evolution, as we recognize it as a social motion of mankind? If these things do not bring with them some security against trouble, what advantage is it to us to measure our so-called progress in terms of our own internal collapse? What we call progress for man is a progress of and by man. If we are building a way of life, it is valuable only to the degree that it serves us. Nature does not require the way of life that we are building. The squirrel still stores its food for the winter. Grasses grow and trees come forth with their wonderful herbage in the spring. Nature does not demand great cities or great enterprises. Nature lives its own continuance in a simple and direct way. Man, of course, does not wish to return to the estate of a woodchuck or something of that nature. But this we must always bear in mind, that if the creative genius of man has caused him to vision beyond nature as he has seen it around him, then this vision must raise him above nature. For a vision which causes him to separate from nature and then become less than nature is no vision at all. It is a nightmare. If, consequently, our thousands of years of civilization
have brought us no more security than that which is enjoyed by the woodchuck. We have not traveled far. If our civilization has not given us an added or greater amount of value, then it has not served us as it should. And if it has not served us, it is because of weakness or defect within it. Thoreau realized that what we call our way of life has become an hypnotic conviction in ourselves, something to be defended whether it is right or not, something that must be endured because it is. And against this fatality, we have no recourse. By degrees, association with a condition breeds a kind of acceptance. Our spirit of rebellion ceases, and we adjust ourselves to these inevitables. Or else, as in the case of youth, particularly in our generation, we observe their motion into escapisms, into science, and into problems of this kind. So man today, in his effort to conquer the moon, finds further excuse to leave himself unconquered. The Thoreau doctrine was that it is far more important for the individual to achieve a kind of victory over confusion and to reintegrate himself as a being than it is for him to expand his resources into innumerable avenues and areas, which can bring him no satisfaction unless he himself is capable of being satisfied, which today he is not. Pleasures around man bring no pleasure to man unless that man himself is pleasant. Securities cannot confer themselves upon a person whose inner life is insecure. Regardless of how many benefits a man may enjoy, he is neither safer nor richer than his own contentment. In obscuring this, in attempting to conceal it from himself and others, man does a bad turn to all concerned. It is a matter of seeking first true value, and upon that building a world. But if we build a world before we have the value, the world we build may be deficient in value. In fact, may be relatively valueless. Knowing that we cannot, and probably should not, attempt a wide rebellion against these different patterns. We have, however, a broad term, nature. Thoreau was a naturalist, but a theoretic one in many ways. He was more of a poet and a mystic than he was a sober scholar. In fact, his sobriety was no part of his philosophy. He believed in living according to a kind of happy madness within himself, with complete disdain for the opinions of his fellow men. It was necessary that he have this disdain, or he could not have survived the pressure. He was a free soul. He lived and died a free soul, a master of his own destiny, and a captain of the ship of his own life. If, then, he had this freedom, this peculiar ability to penetrate sham and pretense, he tried to leave a record of this quality and pointed out how valuable it could be, particularly as the walls of pretense grew higher and stronger with the passing of years. Nature, as he found it by the pool of Walden, was a very pleasant thing moving through seasons. One thing he discovered was that man to live must work. But that man to live must work in the most simple way. That his needs were so essentially few that with a few square yards of earth, he could scratch an existence. But his neighbors insisted that this was little better than pauperism. That the individual who was content to raise from the earth only his food was indeed a poor man, lacking ambition, lacking that drive which causes success and brings with it reputation and regard. Thoreau's philosophy on this subject was rather simple also. If you do your work with your hands and allow your hands to feed your body, then your mind is free to feed your soul. Where if you put mind, hand, spirit, soul, and body all behind the plow, you can plow more rows, but you will die ignorant of everything that is good. That the individual who converges all his resources may attain wealth, but die ignorant, which is the supreme poverty of all. For the individual to be without dreams is to be pauperized. For the individual to be without hopes, moving into the natural and beautiful things of existence, is to be impoverished beyond any concept that we know. Therefore, according to Thoreau, he rather admired some of the old folks in the poorhouse, because actually the sun shone on them just as brightly as on anyone else. And it was far better to have this very strange, sad, and simple life than to be under the tremendous tyranny of success by which the individual betrayed his friend, exploited his own, neglected himself, and practiced treason against his state, all for an almighty dollar. The individual who lives below himself cannot respect himself. And when man loses self-respect, he loses his greater fortune. Thus, there must be some way, without being impractical, without being foolish, without going out perhaps and building a log cabin with your own hands, there must still be a way to rescue nature, to rescue our contact with it. And as he fumbled for an answer, Thoreau reminds us much of the teachings of Taoism in China. This wonderful power of simplicity, this reduction of all things to their essential, for the purpose of buying for man, not goods, but life itself. Dealing in a coinage of contentments, not depending upon various diversions to achieve peace, but rather to find peace itself, the full and complete expression of a way of life endeavor. Thoreau then began by a psychological experiment, which evidently was natural to his own nature. He scarcely expresses it in words, but he certainly implies it in his conduct at each step of his great adventure at Walden Pond. He began to cast off the ballast of false value. He recognized that you cannot free yourself by further entanglement, and that there is no delusion greater than that by which we deceive ourselves by saying, when I have achieved this, when I have accomplished that, when I have amassed those things, then I shall retire and enjoy myself. No man lives so long. Because by that time, he has created habits. Habits themselves so contrary to his enjoyment that he has become a slave of them. And when the time comes for him to retire, it is not the man but his habits that collect the pension. He simply continues to be what he has always been, for he has lost the power to change. If then we are to retire and enjoy life, we must retire at the beginning while we still can. This does not mean that we shall stop work or cease to provide the natural means of our survival. But it means that we shall retire from an illusion, from the delusion of career, the delusion of success, and shall begin from the very start to practice those values which we hope to enjoy at 70 or 75 years of age. There is no reason why we should hold our enjoyments until that period in life when we are least able to enjoy them, or to wait for our vacation to the time when infirmities may make it impossible for us to ever take one. For no individual can take a vacation from rheumatism or hardening of the arteries. From the beginning, therefore, our life should have within it the pleasantries of nature. And if we are by instinct lovers of the wilderness, we can also cultivate certain early associations with mountain and river and stream and desert and seashore. These associations are the least to which we are entitled from our labors. And if we must buy life by our works, then we have a right to spend it as we will. Others, however, do not find escape to the mountains or to the valleys as pleasant as they expect, or have little, if any, inclination for such return to nature. They, however, likewise need the circumstances involved. Perhaps the pool of Walden is our own subconscious. Perhaps it is the inner symbolism of the deep mystery within the heart and soul of ourselves. And by the side of this pool, which is our inner life, this pool, like that of Mimir at the roots of the tree of life in the Nordic legends, here by this pool we build our little hermitage and observe the endless circle of life moving around us, moving actually within us in the fulfillment of its own seasons, its climates, its times, and its dispositions. Thus we all live by the side of the inner pool of our own psychic selves. And we can study this pool and its depths and observe the wonderful life that lives within it. And we can see everywhere things living, things moving, things constantly fulfilling their destinies. And we can become observers of great motions in nature, of the heavens and of the earth. And we can observe all these things toward the attainment of a certain serene humility, a gradual recognition that we are not here to defeat nature, but to fulfill her, that we are not here to gain a military victory over the earth, but rather to come into partnership with the earth, that we are here not to be masters over life, but friends of life. And that our greatest victory is when we help others to succeed. And perhaps the greatest victory of all is when we help nature to attain her victory over us, rather than to forever combat her ways and fight against her moods. Now, anyone on the outer level of things can deny Thoreau's concept. Anyone can point out that nature is eternally encroaching upon man, that man must fight nature in order to survive. but it depends upon the kind of survival that he contemplates. If he wishes to survive against nature, he must fight her to the end, and she will win. But if he wishes to survive with nature, he may unite his resources with her own and come to a splendid victory. Again, it may be said that this is all theory and platitude, that it has little to do with the pressing facts of living. But how comes it then, as Thoreau points out, that the pressing facts of living lead only to death? Why is it that the individual, following what he calls practical ways, comes always to misery?